is the news.
Headlines media report that 9 members of an Afghan family, including 6 children, were killed in a U.S. drone attack on a residential neighborhood of Kabul. Iran's foreign minister, in his meeting with Syria's president, says the presence of foreign forces will not contribute to sustainable security and stability in the region. Also, Category 4 Hurricane Ida makes landfall in the U.S. state of Louisiana, leaving more than 500,000 households without power. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, American media report that a U.S. drone strike targeting a vehicle in a residential neighborhood of Kabul has killed 9 family members, including 6 children. A family member of the deceased is reported as saying that those targeted were ordinary people and did not have any affiliation with Daesh terror group. The U.S. claimed that it destroyed an explosive-laden vehicle that was suspected of preparing to attack Kabul airport. U.S. officials said secondary explosions following the strike showed the vehicle had been carrying a substantial amount of explosive material. The U.S. military later acknowledged that the attack, quote, may have caused civilian casualties. On Thursday, a bomb blast outside Kabul airport killed scores of people, including 13 U.S. troops. The attack was claimed by Daesh. Now, in order to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Mike Harris. He is an editor and also four veterans today joining us out of Phoenix. Mr. Harris, so the U.S. media and military report that the vehicles which were targeted by the U.S. Drone attacks, they had been carrying explosive material, and that, you know, these explosive materials caused secondary explosions which caused the loss of innocent lives. How do you think this secondary explosions can justify the loss of civilians' lives?
I do not. The U.S. drone strikes have a history of killing many, many millions of civilians in Afghanistan and in Iraq. They have a long history of doing this. It cannot be justified. Drone strikes are supposed to be surgical in nature and supposed to only hit the intended target. There was one time when the U.S. struck a wedding party in Afghanistan and killed 47 innocent people because they thought that there might have been a Taliban leader there. That turned out to be false. I believe this story is false as well. First of all, you can't believe anything that the U.S. media tells you, and you can't believe anything that the U.S. government tells you. They are known to lie to our own people here in particular in order to try to gin up war support for a second foray, perhaps going back into Afghanistan, which I hope they do not do. I truly hope that the Taliban shows extreme restraint and does not take the bait and get drawn into further conflict with the U.S., and that the Taliban will guarantee the safety of U.S. citizens getting out of Afghanistan. I really implore them to, because that would be the best way to remove the U.S. presence permanently from Afghanistan. The U.S. has made every mistake militarily and politically that you could make in how they've handled the entire situation with Afghanistan. Everyone needs to remember Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11. And the reason they've been there for the last 20 years is for other reasons, primarily the $3 trillion a year opium trade that they don't want to give up. And the U.S. military, or let me rephrase that, the U.S. intelligence agencies use Daesh as a reason to justify military presence in places that they want to occupy. So Daesh is not what it seems to be. It is an excuse to put U.S. military presence where they don't need. We watched something very similar to this happen when the U.S. was leaving Iraq. And suddenly there was Daesh, and they captured you know, hundreds and hundreds of vehicles that were left for them by General David Petraeus, and then they took the war into Syria. Well, I have met with the Syrian Arab Army, and I know that Daesh was taking their wounded to Israel for treatment. So Daesh is not the radical Islamic organization that is portrayed to be. Far from it. It is a front made to look like a radical Islamic organization in order to give the U.S. and other military powers a reason to continue the military occupation and the war against the Afghan people.
Well, how does this change the dynamics of the evacuation process, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, the U.S. has been very feckless in their approach to using drone strikes. And I'm going to ask the Taliban and their leadership to please show great restraint on this and do not interfere with the evacuation process. As far as the Afghan citizens, they should stay in Afghanistan. But as far as U.S. citizens, do not impede or in any way inhibit the departure of U.S. citizens from Afghanistan. You don't want them there. We would like to have them home safe. And I would really like to, again, ask the Taliban leadership and anyone in a responsible position to not impede their departure from there. Please allow the transport jets to get in and out safely, and allow only U.S. citizens to exit Afghanistan. Keep the Afghan citizens there for themselves. Most of the ones that are exiting now were those who were involved with National Security Director, National Director of Security in Afghanistan, as well as the opium trade. These are the people who are embezzling the billions of dollars from U.S. construction projects. These are the ones that the U.S. wants to get out. None of the people that were in the occupation government in Afghanistan under the U.S. were clean or legitimate people. The U.S. has a long history of working with criminals and gangsters in order to maintain a military presence in whatever country that they're currently waging war with. We saw this in Vietnam. We've seen it in other countries as well. Now we're seeing it in saw it in Afghanistan. This is a very, very corrupt government, very big in the opium trade, very big in a lot of nefarious activities, which is not the reason that the U.S. was in Afghanistan at all. And the entire presence of the U.S. was based on a lie of 9/11. And these chickens are coming home to roost now for the U.S., and it's about time. Now, trust me, I'm a loyal American, but I do not support the criminal government of Joe Biden, and I do not support the criminal occupation that occurred under George W. Bush or any president since then who enabled that. And quite frankly, I'm very angry with how everything has been handled with Afghanistan for the past 20 years, because these are innocent people, mostly agrarian. They live in the hills. They keep to themselves. They don't bother anybody. They're very strict religious Islamic people. There's a little conflict with Christianity there, but they certainly did not deserve 20 years of warfare. And the whole reason for being there was not what they stated there. There was the war on terror was a created war by the U.S. in order to justify military expenditures. There's so much money involved in the U.S. economy based on the war machine, not just the opium trade, which is $3 trillion a year, but the Northrop Grumman's, the McDonnell Douglas's, the Boeing's, all these defense contractors are going to lose money unless the U.S. maintains a state of perpetual warfare. And quite frankly, the U.S. Population is sick of it. We're done. We're tired. We want to bring our folks home, and we want to bring them home safely. So if these companies cannot support their business model without a perpetual war machine, then they need to go out of business and cease to exist. Enough of this already. I mean, I am enraged by this drone strike today, and that they have killed more innocent people and more innocent children. And the Afghan people really have a legitimate complaint against the U.S. Government and how the U.S. has managed this war. These are war crimes, people. And the people who are responsible need to be brought to justice, both domestically here as well as in the international courts. But the American people do not support this. We never have. We never will. We reacted poorly to the 9/11 atrocity. But when you look at 9/11, that is not what they said it was either. That was a big lie. 19 Arabs with box cutters had nothing to do with it. And Afghanistan and the Afghan people had nothing to do with 9/11. This was one of the worst foreign policy mistakes over the last 20 years that any country could have ever made. And shame on the U.S. and shame on U.S. leadership for allowing this to happen.
Thank you so much. I've been talking to Mike Harris. He's an editor with Veterans Today, joining us out of Phoenix. Now let's move on. Remains of the American service members killed in a Thursday bombing in Afghanistan have arrived back in the U.S. The bodies arrived at an airbase in Delaware during a ceremony attended by President Joe Biden and his wife. The service members lost their lives during the evacuation of foreign nationals and locals from the Afghan capital. The bombing outside Kabul Airport marked the deadliest attack for U.S. troops in Afghanistan over a decade. The U.S. has come under criticism over what is seen as a hasty departure from Afghanistan after 20 years of war. The conflict is the longest overseas war the U.S. has waged. Iran's foreign minister is in the Syrian capital, Damascus, following his trip to Iraq. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the presence of foreign forces will not contribute to sustainable security and stability in the region. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali reports.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges. The steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty, and independence in our world, will lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights.
Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people in the fight on terror and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The International Organization for Migration has warned about the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen. The organization wrote on its Twitter page that the country is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It added that well over 16 million Yemenis have no access to safe water and sanitation. The IOM maintained it reached out to more than 2 million Yemenis last year, providing them with water and hygiene services. The organization highlighted in a report that the Saudi war on Yemen keeps displacing citizens. According to the report, 50,000 Yemenis were forced from their homes in the first half of 2021 alone. Category 4 Hurricane Ida has made landfall in the U.S. state of Louisiana. The hurricane is creating winds up to 240 kilometers per hour. Over 300,000 people are asked to take shelter west of New Orleans. More than 500,000 households are left without power. Utility companies say the outages might last for weeks. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has deployed over 2,400 staff to help with rescue operations. The entire National Guards in Louisiana have also been dispatched to join rescue operations. U.S. President Joe Biden says the devastation is likely to be immense. Colin Campbell says people are facing grave danger if not properly sheltered in place.
And of course, when you have winds this strong, anything that is not really locked down or is in the ground very firmly or very substantively is going to be airborne. That could mean houses. That could mean cars, car parts. That could mean signs. That could mean people that are trying to brave the hurricane, which there are many in Louisiana and parts of the Gulf Coast of the United States who think that they have experience in dealing with hurricanes, so they're going to stay right in place. If they aren't protected, if they aren't in a safe location, they too will be at risk of losing their lives. And that's why you had many health officials and state officials really urging people to leave town and so they're not in the line of this hurricane. Otherwise, it could prove to be very, not just catastrophic, but devastating for businesses, for people, for pets even. And they're expecting this to go on for several hours as the Hurricane Ida does not seem to show any signs of slowing down just yet.
Greek police and protesters have clashed during a demonstration in central Athens against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse a group of people who threw flares and other objects during the protest. More than 7,000 people rallied outside the Greek parliament to protest against the mandatory inoculations. Similar rallies in Athens last month also saw violence. About 5.7 million people out of a total population of 11 million have been fully vaccinated in the country. Thousands have taken to the streets of the German capital to protest the government's coronavirus restrictions. The protesters chanted slogans against vaccination programs and called for an end to the pandemic measures. Some demonstrators clashed with the police. The protest took place despite a ban on demonstrations. Germany is facing a fourth wave of COVID infections. On Sunday, it reported around 8,500 new cases in 24 hours. The government has announced that it will stop offering free tests from October the 11th to push more people to get vaccinated. Moreover, people will need to be vaccinated, test negative, or have a health certificate to enter indoor restaurants and gyms. With that, this is for Decision of Word News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The United States has a responsibility to provide a safe haven for refugees from Afghanistan, Latin America, or elsewhere, and to cease interventions that fuel these crises and displace so many. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading, From Afghanistan to Central America, U.S. Creates Refugee Crises. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The United States has long branded itself as a safe haven for refugees fleeing war and persecution abroad. The current U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is actually a testament to that, with well over 100,000 people evacuated by U.S. since mid-August. Despite this historic airlift, the Biden administration is being relentlessly criticized. The airlift continued despite a double suicide bombing at the gates of the Kabul airport recently that killed at least 9 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members, injuring at least 140. If there is any chaos as U.S.-aligned Afghans scramble to flee their war-torn nation, blame lies primarily with the U.S. administration. And President Trump's right-hand man, his racist, xenophobic advisor, Stephen Miller. Another exodus is happening halfway around the world as asylum seekers from Central America make the perilous journey to the U.S.-Mexico border. There, they face draconian U.S. immigration policies that consign them to remain in Mexico. Much like Afghan civilians caught in the crossfire of that 20-year war, these migrants live in constant danger in squalid, makeshift refugee camps in the Mexican border cities, waiting for a chance at asylum in the United States. If there is any chaos as U.S.-aligned Afghans scramble to flee their war-torn nation, blame lies primarily with the United States administration. Miller's anti-immigrant fervor was driven early on by listening to right-wing radio host Larry Elder, who is now the leading candidate to replace California Governor Gavin Newsom in a recall election. Olivia Troy, who was an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, tweeted recently, "The war cabinet MTGS about this during the Trump administration, where Stephen Miller would peddle his racist hysteria about Iraq and Afghanistan. He and his enablers across government would undermine anyone who worked on solving the SIV or special immigrant visa issue by devastating the system at DHS and state. Trump had 4 years to evacuate these Afghan allies who were the lifelines for many of us who spent time in Afghanistan. They had been waiting a long time. The process slowed a trickle for reviews and other priorities then came to a halt." Miller also engineered the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, better known as the Remain in Mexico policy. Human Rights First recently issued a report, Deliver to Danger, that documented at least 1,544 publicly reported cases of murder, rape, torture, kidnapping, and other violent assaults against asylum seekers and migrants forced to return to Mexico by the U.S. administration. A 97-page appendix accompanies the report, listing the crimes with chilling detail. On Inauguration Day, President Biden issued several executive orders, including one revoking the anti-immigrant executive order Trump issued during his first week in office in 2017. The Department of Homeland Security immediately suspended enrolling migrants in the MPP program. In response, the states of Texas and Missouri sued the Biden administration, and on August 13th, Texas federal judge Matthew Kaczmarek, a Trump appointee, ruled that the White House must immediately re-implement the remaining Mexico policy. The U.S. Justice Department appealed, and within 2 weeks, a three-judge appeals court affirmed the lower court's decision. Two of those three appeals court judges were Trump appointees. Andrew Oldham, who was just 39, when confirmed to his lifetime appointment in 2018, and Corey Wilson, who is now 51. Both are fierce right-wing ideologues. A request for stay pending federal litigation was quickly rejected by the Supreme Court by 6-3. The Biden administration still uses Title 42, first deployed by Trump, allowing deportations and immigration bans in times of public health emergencies. Trump's CDC issued the Title 42 order in March 2020 as the pandemic swept the globe, and Biden renewed it on August 2nd. The U.S. government reported a record 210,000 migrant apprehensions along the southern border in July. Many of these people hail from the so-called Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, where widespread inequality, systematic corruption, food insecurity, gang violence, and now climate change are forcing people from their homes. These problems have long been exacerbated by U.S. military, economic, and political interventions in the region. The United States engaged in dirty wars in Central America and has supported coups against democratically elected governments there, from overthrowing the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954 to actively supporting the coup against President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. Likewise, the United States armed and supported the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. Many of those armed Mujahideen then aimed their American weapons at the U.S. This led to the disastrous two-decades-long U.S. war, with tens of thousands killed and millions displaced. The United States regime has a responsibility to provide a safe haven for refugees from Afghanistan, Latin America, or elsewhere, and to cease interventions that fuel these crises and displace so many.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the arrival of the month of Muharram. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you.
You're welcome, brother. And also, brother Ali Alavian is over here, an Islamic expert from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and very welcome to this show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, Since this is the month of Muharram and the most tragic event during the history took place in this month, that is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members, his faithful, loyal companions, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, decided to dedicate this session and the upcoming ones to the atrocities and the corruptions that were done by the Umayyads during their rulership over Muslim lands. We know that from 41, we can say AH, till 132 AH, for 91 years, the Umayyad established a government on the Muslim lands, starting from Levant and getting all across the borders of the Muslim lands out of Arab Peninsula and Hejaz, today Saudi Arabia. But all of a sudden, many values have been changed, and many pure Islamic values have been violated. We know that the most horrendous, we can say, massacres happened during this period. We could see that what happened to the family and the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We could remember what they have done to, in fact, in the Harra event, the massacre of the people and the killing of the people over there. Also, Mukhtar al-Saghafi uprised against them, but he was killed again. And you know that in these 91 years, we can say Islam was deviated from the right path. This was what Umayyads did, Umayyads and their kings and the rulers did to the Muslim Ummah at that time. After the death of Muawiyah, how Yazid unlawfully and illegitimately got to the power, they want to start a kind of, Morusi or hereditary type of transfer of the power to themselves from the father to the son. And brothers and sisters, just go and check our Sunni references, not the Shia ones, that what a picture Yazid had on that time. The atrocities, the corruption that he did. And the first thing that he did was to take bay'ah from four: Hussein ibn Ali, Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdurrahman ibn Abi Bakr, and Abdullah ibn Zubair. And anyone who confronted you, cut his head and behead his head. Mas'udi in his tariq says that, in his book says that, he was very much like Pharaoh, but Pharaoh was better than Yazid.
Yes.
But Pharaoh was better than Yazid. The rivers of the blood and the streams of blood that he did. On that time, such a guy like Yazid ibn Muawiyah. So, Brother Ali al-Evyan, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did not accept it. As you said, did Khuruj, and on his way, he was to Karbala and then the Kufa, according to the invitation.
It is some, as I said, some believe that Imam did Khuruj, and we do not agree with this term.
No, I mean by Khuruj is that he left Medina
As a sign of
Karbala.
His disagreement.
Yes.
Since he found actually that he finds that the people's acceptance can be actually in the Kufa, he started moving towards there, and he left, and he found even look when the Islam. The expediency of Islamic Ummah is even more important than the rituals and worships. That's
right.
Why he leaves his Hajj incomplete. This is the Imam, this is an Islamic leader that knows that the expediency of Islamic Ummah obliges him to leave his Hajj incomplete. While you can find no one that is permitted to leave his Hajj incomplete. So he moves towards Kufa, and on the way. On his way in Karbala, actually, he was martyred by in a sad and really tragic event by the troops of Yazid and with his representative in Kufa, that is Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
That's right.
So Imam was martyred in a really tragic way. He and his family and his 72 loyal companions. And his family were arrested and were sent to Shaman.
That's right.
The whole story that some...
Okay, Dr. Fahd Rouhani, let's get to the post-event. The Karbala tragedy is so harsh and tragic that all the details cannot be mentioned over here. Sorry for, as they say, It includes graphic video.
Mm.
It includes graphic events over here. We cannot say what atrocity did Yazid, Obaidullah ibn Ziyad, Shamr ibn Zarjoshan, and the other agents of Yazid detour, the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the women and the children. But the case is that after the captives are taken to the Yazid's court, the heads are over there. He starts drinking liquor, and putting trays of chess, playing chess on the heads of the Ahlul Bayt and drinking liquor. He was himself criticized by the people around him, his viziers and the ministers around him, but he continues doing so. I mean, such behaviors from a guy like Yazid and the cruelty that he did towards Ahlul Bayt. What was the main reason for Yazid to show such vengeance toward Ahlul Bayt, not acting mercifully even to their bodies and their heads?
Yeah, the point is simply that he wanted to take revenge and he wanted to silence all others and show that, okay, look, he was the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, okay, and I ordered him to be beheaded,
yeah,
and his body to be,
mutilated.
Mutilated.
Yes.
Okay, trampled.
Trampled,
okay?
Mutilated.
Yes, and then, first of all, Yazid wanted to show that he was the absolute power over there, and wanted to silence all others. We find that, I mean, the reign of terror in the Umayyad period continued, I mean, from the time of Muawiyah up to the end of the period of Yazid, okay? And after Yazid, we find that Marwanids got to power, okay? However, we find that, okay, Yazid's main power was, Yazid's main intention was, not only to silence all his opponents, but to cut off the line of the Ahlul Bayt, okay? But it was just a vain hope. I mean, it was a foolish hope.
That's right.
Because Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, okay, was a survivor of the Ashura tragedy, okay? Now we find that, even some historians who were courtiers, either in the time of the Umayyads or in the time of the Abbasids, when they come to Yazid ibn Muawiyah, they cannot resist, this feeling, okay, to write down, okay, what realities took place over there. Although they were, courtiers, and they were paid by the government, okay, in order to write the history in favor of the Umayyads and favor of the Abbasids. In some places, they reveal some of the secrets, okay, that took place, that were used to be, that were used to take place inside the Umayyad courts. Okay?
Although doing curse or doing land towards the companions and the caliphs of the Muslim lands are considered as forbidden by some of our Sunni brethren, but according to authentic resources like Ahmad ibn Hanbal Zahabi, Ibn Ibad, Ibn Imad Hanbali, Ibn Jawzi, and Ibn al-Khaldun, cursing Yazid ibn Muawiyah according to a consensus was done. And see how much a person could be corrupted and how much a scandal he could make during the Muslim moment.
May I have a short comment? Knowing about the reasons of this oppression that he made towards the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam requires to study about the characteristics of the characteristics and features of the government which was introduced by Muawiyah from Yazid, and actually they were the basis of this Umayyad dynasty. In the sense that they reached to power officially, and I think it requires to see how they started to expand corruption, cruelty, and also eliminating the Islamic values like piety and ruling unpious people over the others and choosing people to lead as the governors and commanders of the people, those who did not really actually have the qualifications to be selected as these right. for these positions. These are, I think, requires okay. to talk about in depth and details, right. inshallah, in upcoming sessions.
Let me finish this program with a couplet from the famous Persian poet Sanai Ghaznavi. I read it in Persian and translated it into English. داستان پسر هند مگر نشنیدی که از او بر سر اولاد پیامبر چه رسید. Haven't you heard the story of the son of Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan, that what he did do to the descendants of Prophet Muhammad? پدر او لب و دندان پیامبر بشکست. His father has broken the mouth, the jaws, and the tooth of Prophet Muhammad. مادر او جگر عم پیامبر بمکید.
Hamza
Sayyid al-Shuhada is referring to the uncle of Prophet Muhammad. خود به ناحق حق داماد پیامبر بگرفت. Imam Ali alayhi salam was in fact neglected of his right, that is the right of successorship as imamate. پسر او سر فرزند پیامبر ببرید. He is referring to Yazid, cutting off the head of the Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And this is the last line. بر چنین قوم چرا لعنت و نفرین نکنم؟ Why am I not accursing and cursing such a tribe? لعن الله یزید و علی آل یزید. May curse be upon Yazid and the descendants of Yazid ibn Muawiyah. This was a couplet done by Sanai Ghaznavi, the famous Persian poet. Really beautiful. And it has all the history from pre-Islamic period, from Abu Sufyan, the father of Muawiyah, up until Yazid ibn Muawiyah. May Allah curse them all. Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani and Brother Ali Alavian.
Thanks to you, brother.
For your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. May Allah accept all of our mournings and azadaris and this majalis that we do for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the man who said no to the oppression of Yazid ibn Muawiyah and wanted to revive the pure Muhammadan Islam. For more information on this program, visit our website, parstoday.com/Yankalav Islam page. Do not forget us in these supplications and the morning ceremonies and the rallies and demonstrations for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the months of Muharram all across the world. Take care. The pandemic is killing, but held your ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, even if it is online. Brothers, do not forget that these sha'ir and the rituals has to be enlivened, even if they are digital and online. Do your marasim and majalis and takaya for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. May Allah bless you all. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein.
Look ya Zahra.
Look ya Zahra.
Look ya Zahra. Fell on the desert camping, a lonely voice was heard in mourning. Then she looked and saw someone approaching, one who would join her in her grieving. She had come to see her progeny and what had become of their destiny. But she could not let her to go closer. She did not want her to really see. I do not want you to go further. You will only see pain and horror. Body with no head, 72 dead. Zainab said, do not look ya Zahra.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight. A rapid Taliban takeover, a chaotic evacuation, and a deadly terror attack in Afghanistan have shaken confidence in the commander-in-chief and U.S. leadership. We're prepared for you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled Biden's Worst Nightmare: How Afghanistan Shook a President. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. U.S. President Joe Biden bowed his head at the lectern, as if the weight of the world were on his shoulders. In his breast pocket was a card that keeps a tally of American service members who have died in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now he knew it would include people who died serving under him as commander-in-chief. Addressing the nation from the East Room of the White House, Joe Biden had just endured the bleakest day of his young presidency. In Kabul, a suicide bomber and gunman killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghan civilians, two British nationals and the child of a British national. Like many presidents before him, Biden was required to move rapidly through emotional keys. There was compassion for the U.S. war dead, the so-called heroes who have been engaged in a dangerous, selfless mission to supposedly save the lives of others. Then a dark warning for terrorists reminiscent of former U.S. President George W. Bush. We will not forgive, we will not forget, we will hunt you down and make you pay. A day later, Biden ordered a drone strike in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province, which the Pentagon claimed killed two Daesh terrorists. In a statement on Saturday, 28th of August, Joe Biden said, "This strike was not the last." After half a century in national politics, Biden finds himself tested as never before. He came into office in January, identifying multiple crises, but did not mention Afghanistan in his inaugural address. The unforeseen catastrophe has diminished his standing at home and America's stature abroad. It was just last month that the president, implacably resolved to withdraw U.S. occupation forces by 31st of August, declared that the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely, only to watch impotently as the militants did just that, upending two decades of purported human rights gains in only 2 weeks. America's allies, who assumed that the defeat of Donald Trump would at least make America competent again, felt blindsided. The U.S. struck an uneasy truce with the Taliban and undertook what may prove the biggest airlift in history, evacuating more than 100,000 people from the crowded, chaotic Kabul airport. Then on Thursday, 26th of August, the Daesh terrorist group struck, inflicting the deadliest attack on U.S. occupying forces in Afghanistan in a decade and killing dozens of Afghans desperate to flee. As horrifying images flashed around the world, the White House sought to project calm. News of the attack broke as Joe Biden's national security team were in the Situation Room. When the president walked in, one of the first updates he received was about the atrocity in Kabul. Details came in through the day from commanders on the ground. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, told reporters on Thursday evening, 26th of August, "Any day where you'd lose service members may be the worst day of your presidency, and hopefully there's not more. But we're certainly early in the presidency at this point in time, so I would say he was somber and, as he said today, outraged at these terrorist takings, the lives of service members. It was a day of raw emotion, unlike any other in the Biden White House," the Politico website reported. According to a person close to the Situation Room, during one staff meeting, sniffles could be heard at various staffers fought back tears when they learned of the American deaths. One White House official described the pace of the day's events as overwhelming. The 78-year-old president, whose own life is freighted with personal tragedies, would have been hit hard by the losses. Leon Panetta, a former CIA director and former defense secretary under President Barack Obama, can recall standing alongside then Vice President Joe Biden when America's war dead were flown home to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. Leon Panetta said on Friday, 27th of August, "It was clear to me that he really felt deeply about the impact the loss of a loved one had on these families. I'm sure it's something that he's going to have to carry now for these next number of days as president, recognizing that the loss of life took place during his presidency." He added, "It had to be President Biden's worst nightmare to have lost that many U.S. service members in one blow, when his hope, I think, had always been to be able to bring our presence in Afghanistan to an end without losing another American. To have that happen, I'm sure, probably represented his worst day in office." For now, the frantic evacuation continues under constant threat of further attacks, racing to meet the deadline of 31st of August. There is little doubt some U.S. citizens and many thousands of Afghan allies will still be in the country after that date. Their fate remains deeply uncertain and could cast a lasting pall over Joe Biden's legacy. The debacle has drawn the harshest rebukes of his seven-month presidency, with some Republicans demanding his impeachment or resignation. Donald Trump called the retreat from Afghanistan the single greatest humiliation in our history. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik insisted that Joe Biden had blood on his hands. Democratic leaders have generally remained diplomatic, but some members of Congress have spoken out or at least urged an extension to the deadline. Seth Moulton, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran who made the surprise trip to Kabul airport in recent days, told New York Magazine, "The thing that everyone needs to understand, even if you completely agree with the Biden administration's decision to withdraw, the way they have handled this has been a total disaster. It will be measured in bodies because a lot of people are dying because they can't get out." Other Western nations rapidly wound down evacuation efforts after the bombing. For allies, there is bitter disappointment. Joe Biden had been seen as a so-called steady hand who could restore U.S. leadership on the world stage. Scathing comments expressed at a recent session of the British Parliament made clear how faith in American hegemony has been shaken. Leon Panetta, co-founder of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy, said, "I don't think there's any question that when the picture of that chaos at the airport was shown around the world, it impacted on the credibility of the United States, particularly the sense that our allies, frankly, did not play much of a role in terms of the decision itself, and obviously were not part of the lot of strategizing that took place. I think he's got some work cut out for him to try to restore credibility, particularly with our allies." Yet, to the dismay of many, Joe Biden has dug in, given no inch, acknowledged no error, and shown no contrition. He claimed the deal struck by his predecessor, Donald Trump, with the Taliban, the U.S. occupation forces to leave by May, left him with only two choices, withdraw or escalate. The American public, exhausted by America's longest war, had no desire for the latter. Some observers have been puzzled that Joe Biden's much-vaunted empathy displayed for American troops has been less copious for Afghan women and girls, now at the mercy of the Taliban, and that a man steeped in foreign policy has unapologetically prioritized American interests. Ivan Osnos, a Biden biographer, said, "The moment reflected a collision of two of his instincts, the total frustrated determination to act on 12 years of wanting out of Afghanistan, combined with a smaller C conservative calculation about America's interests. The fact is, and he would acknowledge this, that he thinks more about members of the American military than he does about Afghans who worked with Americans or for them. His compassion has limits." Biden's popularity has taken a hit, dipping below 50% for the first time in opinion polls. However, he's fortunate that the midterm elections that will decide the balance of power in Congress are still 15 months away, an eternity in political news cycles. It is far from certain that he will suffer long-term damage for ending a war that had become profoundly unpopular. Indeed, some Democratic strategists caution against a rush to judgment. Bob Shroom, director of the USC Dornsife Center for the Political Future, said, "There was obviously an intelligence failure which I don't think can be blamed on Biden. They've done as well as you possibly could under the most adverse circumstances imaginable." Bob Shroom added, "I mean, this will have been the most successful airlift of evacuees in the history of warfare, or maybe in history, period." He added, "All these people are prematurely saying, oh well, that's the end of Biden, that's totally ahistorical, and fails to recognize that we've been through things like this before."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.